From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. We will momentarily address a devolutionary change, but first, what you already knew, namely that for 20 years, Fox News Channel has been a right-wing blast furnace.
A fist bump, a pound, a terrorist fist jab, the gesture everyone seems to interpret differently.
We keep marrying other species and other ethnic groups. Yeah. The Swedes have pure genes. Because okay. They marry other Swedes, because that's the rule. Finland, Finns marry other Finns, so they have a pure society. In America, we marry everybody.
You're a Muslim, so why did you write a book about the founder of Christianity?
Well, to be clear, I am a scholar of religions with 4 degrees, including one in the New Testament.
Fox News Channel does boast a relatively straightforward news operation. But as with its competitors, actual news is more fuel than product. Indeed, the daylight news reports are mainly just window dressing. The channel's big audiences, its clout, and its very raison d'etre as counter-programming to the supposed liberal agenda of the mainstream news have always resided in the morning and primetime talk shows. On such programs as The O'Reilly Factor, Hannity, and Fox and Friends, the channel has spent 2 decades as a de facto house organ for the Republican Party, sparing no amount of bile, bellicosity, and distortion in the process.
This evil, evil man.
This comes out of Louisiana State University. A professor there has examined just what damage Mr. Rogers may have done to this whole crop of kids who now feel entitled just for being them.
Mr. Rogers, enemy of the people. And here with Bill O'Reilly, the son of a 9/11 victim.
You evoke sympathy with the 9/11 families.
That's a bunch of crap. I've done more for the 9/11 families, by their own admission. I've done more for them than you will ever hope to do.
Okay.
So you keep your mouth shut.
Crusader in the culture wars, demonizer of liberals and Democrats, blah, blah, blah. The self-described fair and balanced channel, that relentless sledgehammer pounding a political wedge, might well recast its famous slogan, "We purport, you divide." And on dividing, maybe one last excerpt, courtesy of the blonde bomber, Ann Coulter.
So I used to think women just shouldn't be able to vote. Now I think at least liberal women should not be able to hold office.
Sort of amazing, but also more or less routine. Fox has made billions of dollars exploiting the politics of resentment. It is so predictably incendiary and partisan, in fact, that this program ordinarily pays it little mind. If OTM were to focus on every Fox outrage, we'd have to change our name to the Hen House and be all Fox criticism all the time. But in the past month, simply put, conditions have changed, because the biggest megaphone of the so-called vast right-wing conspiracy has suddenly become a walkie-talkie. The president, who declared war on mainstream news organizations, has found a BFF and creepy codependent in Fox.
Fox and Friends in the morning, they're very honorable people. They're very, not because they're good, because they hit me also when I do something wrong, but they have the most honest morning show.
Foxism and Trumpism were made for one another. The problem is, like fertilizer and fuel oil, the whole is more dangerous than the sum of its parts. The Trump-Fox symbiosis is a perfect feedback loop in which the president's agenda informs Fox's obsequious coverage and Fox's reactionary coverage informs the president's thinking. The second element of that symbiosis is the consequence of a president of the United States who reportedly gets most of his intelligence on domestic and world affairs by surfing cable in his jammies.
One of the best examples came before dawn, 5:50 in the morning, one of the president's first days in office.
Brian Stelter, senior media correspondent at CNN and host of Reliable Sources.
He's watching a segment on the Fox and Friends First Show about Chelsea Manning being critical of President Obama.
In a new article for The Guardian, the disgraced former Army private is slamming Obama as a weak leader with few permanent accomplishments.
The banner on the bottom of the screen said, "Ungrateful traitor." There's no subtlety on Fox News. So 14 minutes later, those are the exact words the president is using on Twitter.
He tweeted, quote, ungrateful traitor Chelsea Manning, who never should have been released from prison, is now calling President Obama a weak leader. Terrible.
And we see this time and time again, from Fox and Friends first at 5:50 a.m. all the way to the O'Reilly Factor and Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity at night.
Well, you know, coincidences happen, but...
Sure. Some of the president's tweets, it's hard to determine what channel he was watching and exactly what he saw, but then there are times it's very clear. On the O'Reilly Factor, a guest brought up the idea of sending in the feds to Chicago to try to stem the violence there.
First 23 days of this year, 42 homicides in the Windy City, up 24% from last year.
I don't know another word besides carnage to describe the devastation that's been taking place.
If I were president, I'd say, you know what? For the next month, we're going to have the guard in these neighborhoods to stop this.
You know, within an hour, the president's tweeting the same statistics and suggesting the same idea, making the same threat.
The tweet reading, if Chicago doesn't fix the horrible carnage going on with 42 killings, up 24%, I will send in the feds.
This is the kind of demonstration of President Trump watching cable news and reacting to it in real time that we've never seen from a president.
We're speaking on Thursday. The week began with an assertion by the president at a campaign rally where he said this.
You look at what's happening in Germany. You look at what's happening last night in Sweden. Sweden. Who would believe this? Sweden.
Now, that was odd because there were certain parties who were unaware of anything untoward happening in Sweden. And that includes a party called Sweden. they were at a loss to understand what Trump was referring to. But you know exactly what he was referring to.
Tucker Carlson, 9 p.m. Friday night. Tucker Carlson had interviewed a conservative filmmaker who went to Sweden trying to investigate what he says is a surge in violence caused by refugees and migrants in the country.
Perhaps no nation on earth is more committed to accepting foreign migrants and refugees in Sweden.
There was an absolute surge in both gun violence and rape in Sweden once they began this open-door policy.
Now, our own State Department and other government sources, as well as Swedish government sources, contradict a lot of what this filmmaker was saying. But the president was receiving his information from that Fox News segment and then strangely referring to last night in Sweden, when what he meant was last night on Fox News when I heard about Sweden.
What's happening here?
What we are seeing is a pro-Trump channel. And there is this walkie-talkie effect that you're describing between them. When the president says something that's false, you're not going to hear as much about that on Fox News as you are from other corners of the media. But I would tell you, the Murdochs, who own Fox, would disagree with that sentence. They would say, no, that's not what we are. We're not pro-Trump. We are a right-leaning channel holding Trump accountable from the right. And Bob, I'm trying to find examples of that because that's going to be a big story. If Fox News really is there to hold the president accountable from the right, then that's going to make for some compelling television.
Brian, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Brian Stelter, host of CNN's Reliable Sources. The problem is the accountability bit isn't true. An occasional expression of skepticism about the president's conservative bona fides is lost in the cacophony of Trump talking points and boosterism. More than boosterism, actually, because when Trump lies or deflects his own outrages, Fox can be counted on to click its heels. For instance, when his national security advisor Michael Flynn was revealed by leaked intelligence to have lied about talking with the Russians about sanctions, the president tweeted his anger not about diplomatic subversion, but about the leaks themselves, followed by his fave-rave Steve Doocy on Fox and Friends with this.
Looks kind of shady. Just the fact that there are these leaks inside the permanent government is troubling.
And when Trump made the preposterous claim that the media, following some sort of freedom-hating agenda, were suppressing news about terror attacks, Sean Hannity rushed to his aid.
That was President Trump yesterday claiming the mainstream media often underreports terror attacks all across the globe, which I agree with. Naturally, many members of the press took offense to those comments, even with some suggesting that the president was actually lying, which is now their favorite obsession.
Fox maintains that journalistic rules don't apply, that its primetime stars are commentators, not reporters. True, Hannity, O'Reilly, and Fox and Friends don't constitute news, but nor do they trade in the informed, rigorously argued opinion that is a hallmark of journalism. What they offer is more like propaganda, political messaging on behalf of a regime often shamefully untethered from the truth. Under the Trump presidency, Fox has finally devolved into state television of the Putin kind. If you wish to see it's like on cable TV, don't tune to CNN or even MSNBC. Try the channel RT, which is short for Russia Today. Coming up, will sanctuary cities save undocumented immigrants? Probably not. This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
One of my first acts will be to get all of the drug lords, all of the bad ones. We have some bad, bad people in this country that have to go out.
Donald Trump's campaign rhetoric about ridding the United States of dangerous outsiders is now becoming a reality.
Immigration raids, some communities on edge after a string of deportation raids in at least six states.
8-year-old Kelly was born in the United States, but her parents are undocumented. And at the mention of her father currently in ICE detention, she can't stop crying. Her mother, among those living in fear that their families may soon be torn apart.
In Texas, agents with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, entered the El Paso County Courthouse last week in order to arrest an undocumented woman who'd gone to court seeking a protective order against her alleged domestic abuser.
Several studies show that immigrants actually commit fewer violent crimes than the population at large, but as we are reminded every day, facts are of no concern to an administration swept into office on the politics of xenophobia and lies. So now, with two new executive orders in hand and guidelines for their implementation released this week, the Department of Homeland Security is dismantling the protocols that obliged immigration police to prioritize the most flagrant or dangerous cases involving the undocumented.
Immigration officers are now going to have much broader discretion to decide who to round up in the first place. So, practically speaking here, if an agent goes on a raid to find a criminal undocumented immigrant, anyone else who happens to be with that person at the same time who's also here unlawfully may now be deported.
This includes those who have been convicted of any criminal offense, charged with any criminal offense, committed acts that constitute perhaps a chargeable criminal offense, or, quote, otherwise pose a risk to public safety or national security. So, basically, everyone. Immigration lawyer Muzaffer Chishti says a zero-tolerance image is what the Trump administration seeks to portray, but he also believes it's in large part just smoke and handcuffs.
You know, I think the effort here is to create a feeling that this is a different day in the world of immigration enforcement, and there is a new sheriff in town. To round up all 11.2 million people in the country is physically, constitutionally, legally, and operationally impossible. So therefore, there is much more a narrative here of enforcement than there will be a real sustainable level of immigration enforcement. the Obama administration gets the credit for having removed in any one year the largest number of people, the peak of removals in 2011, about 450,000 people. Any expert on immigration enforcement believes that to remove much larger group of people is very difficult for a couple of reasons. A, it requires many more resources, and Congress hasn't given those resources to the executives yet. Secondly, there's due process of law, which slows any person's removal. Third, it requires a significant amount of international cooperation. I mean, hidden in these executive orders is the belief that Mexico is just voluntarily going to take all Mexicans that we want to remove, or all Central Americans and other South Americans that cross through the Mexican territory to the United States back to their country. I mean, it's almost the same narrative as saying Mexico will pay for the wall. You make statements without ever having verified from the government that is implicated in that.
The Trump administration has talked about hiring 5,000 new border agents and 10,000 ICE officers to do the job. Is that a plausible notion?
The fact is that we have been having difficulty recruiting border officers for which slots have already been allotted. About 60% of them cannot pass a polygraph test. To hire a federal enforcement official is always a very tedious task. It takes typically about 18 months. So just to say that we're going to hire 5,000 Border Patrol agents, 10,000 ICE agents, as if it's going to happen tomorrow, is one more sort of indication as to why the rhetoric is more dominant here than facts.
So you believe that it's impractical and part of a kind of PR show, but in the meantime, a lot of people are going to be caught up in the show.
Let's not sort of underemphasize the alarming nature of this development. The principal effect is that it instills fear and unpredictability in a large section of the unauthorized population, which until recently had begun to have certain semblance of a normal life. That if you're just an ordinary status violator, not committed a crime, you can get up in the morning, go to work, and hope that you can come back and see your children at night again. That certainty now has been removed. People are anxious and will be anxious at all times under this order because it makes everyone a priority.
I've mentioned that data about undocumented aliens and crime does not support the notion that it is an especially criminal cohort. But on the campaign trail, Trump cherry-picked anecdotes, horrifying ones, about victims of crimes committed by undocumented residents.
In the audience tonight, we have four mothers, unbelievable people that I've gotten to know over a period of years, whose children have been killed, brutally killed, by people that came into the country illegally.
My name is Ruth Johnston Martin. My husband was shot by an illegal alien. He fought the good fight, but he took his last breath in 2002.
As I understand the new rules, there's actually a provision to highlight, to publicize crimes committed by the undocumented. Tell me about VOICE.
So VOICE is a subdepartment created in the Immigration and Customs Enforcement called Victims of Immigration Crime Engagement. And this is going to provide support to victims of crimes. But also, most importantly, it's going to provide the names of all people who have committed these crimes, where they committed them, what their status was, what their history was. And this is a reversal of a policy that federal government has had over time where you would not reveal the information that government had on individual cases. At the same time, they want to highlight those jurisdictions in the country, states and localities, which do not honor detainers from the federal government. And if those jurisdictions release people, they then proceed to commit a crime. They want to highlight every crime of the person, clearly to shame the cities. I have actually never seen a situation where a president of the United States uses government information to shame another law enforcement agency. I think that is unprecedented. You know, let me also just highlight one more thing. The president sustained his campaign by parading the victims of the crimes of unauthorized and highlighting the unsympathetic unauthorized people. And it worked very well for him. I think what we'll begin to see is sympathetic people, just mothers and grandmothers and cooks and soccer coaches being handcuffed. And the narrative will shift from the unsympathetic to the sympathetic. And that may provide a different kind of a public relations challenge that the president may not be prepared for.
On the other hand, isn't it exactly what the president wants to project? Law and order, tough on crime, cracking down on illegal immigration?
I think that's absolutely true. I think what this level and nature of enforcement will prove is that not all unauthorized people are equal. There are sympathetic people among the unauthorized as there are sympathetic people among all populations. No one is expecting to give a standing ovation to an unauthorized person. That's not what policy tries to elicit. All that decent policy tries to say is that, look, there are nuances among populations. And in a world of limited resources, even the best resource enforcement agency has to draw priorities. No agency has enough resource to go after a child rapist and a jaywalker at the same time. And there's a security component to this, which will also, I think, ultimately cost the president. If resources are spent going after jaywalkers, that's less resources to go after child molesters. And then at some point we'll see that has a significant public security component, which may begin to affect the narrative of the president.
Muzaffar, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Muzaffar Chishti is lawyer and director of the Migration Policy Institute's office at the New York University School of Law. As Trump's immigration policies dominate the news cycle, funding to sanctuary cities has been at the heart of the debate.
There's been a lot of talk about cutting funding for sanctuary cities.
We will end the sanctuary cities that have resulted in so many needless deaths.
Today, San Francisco became the first sanctuary city to file a lawsuit against President Trump over his executive order requiring them to comply with immigration authorities or lose federal funding.
To immigrant advocates, the word sanctuary might connote safe haven from the cruelty of the deportation machine. But that overstates just how much refuge they provide. Daniel Denver is a fellow at the Fair Punishment Project. Daniel, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me first what sanctuary cities were meant to be and what they've agreed to do.
Well, there's no precise definition for the term, but generally what they mean at a minimum is that a city or locality will not cooperate actively with ICE deportations, meaning two things. One, that they will not participate in something called the 287G program, which effectively deputizes local jailers and police to actively enforce immigration laws. And second is that localities will not agree to cooperate with ICE requests to detain immigrants who have been arrested past their scheduled release time.
And that's the illegality that President Trump refers to when he threatens to deny federal funding to sanctuary cities. Is it a kind of municipal civil disobedience? Is it flouting the law or something different?
No, it's entirely up to localities whether or not they cooperate with ICE in these cases. In fact, federal courts have ruled in recent years that localities may be civilly liable if they hold on to undocumented immigrants without probable cause. So a number of localities, not just those governed by left-leaning Democrats, restricted their cooperation with ICE because if they hold someone without probable cause, and let's say they turn out to be a U.S. citizen, which has happened before, then they could be held civilly liable.
All right. So ICE wants local law enforcement to detain and turn over suspected undocumented residents, and they say no, and therefore, kumbaya, we have protected a whole category of residents under siege by the administration. But you say, well, no, not exactly. Why not exactly?
Yeah, if only it were so simple. I mean, I do want to make clear that it has been a huge victory for the immigrant rights movement that, beginning under Obama, began pushing mayors and city councils to restrict cooperation with ICE and cease agreeing to hold unauthorized immigrants at ICE's behest. But there's a program called Secure Communities, which was initiated under President Bush and rolled out nationally under Obama. And what it did was merge a fingerprint database whereby localities booking people into local jails share their fingerprints with the FBI with an ICE database, allowing ICE to identify possible undocumented immigrants. So whether or not cities are cooperating actively with ICE, ICE will be tipped off to possible undocumented immigrants at the point of arrest. Obama changed the name of Secure Communities to the Priority Enforcement Program, but Trump is now resurrecting Secure Communities in its entirety.
So if you're undocumented and you should wind up in the criminal justice system, let's say in San Francisco, the sanctuariest of sanctuary cities, large crime or petty violation, guilty or innocent, once you're booked, federal officials will have access to your fingerprints and may just come to fetch you.
Yeah, even if you've been released, if ICE determines that you might be an undocumented immigrant, there's nothing stopping them from tracking you down at your workplace or your home. And so I think we need to expand the definition of sanctuary cities to include not just non-cooperation with ICE, but dramatically reducing the number of people who are arrested, prosecuted, and incarcerated in major cities in the United States.
All right. I understand that cities can take it upon themselves to actually arrest fewer people for relatively petty crimes, but there's a certain policing strategy called broken windows, which is all about suppressing petty crimes in order to create a safer environment. Can you be a sanctuary and follow the broken windows philosophy at the same time?
No. The thing about broken windows policing is that its adherents never actually tried to just fix the broken windows, instead going out and arresting people for loitering or turnstile jumping or whatever nickel and dime crime it may be. If cities are actually concerned with improving quality of life and lowering crime in poor, marginalized communities, then they should start with fixing broken windows, giving people homes, improving the quality of people's schools. Those are the sort of solutions that will have an impact in lowering crime without the harm of unnecessarily bringing people into contact with the criminal justice system. Arresting people for small-scale crime isn't just a bad idea because it brings immigrants in contact with a system that can lead to deportation, but because being arrested for a small-scale crime can lead to all sorts of nasty consequences for anyone who's brought into the system. People who are brought into the system are more likely to end up in contact with the system again and again and again.
So what you're saying is, in order for sanctuary cities to truly provide sanctuary, they have to make a policy decision to do the counterintuitive, which is to not arrest people for various kinds of petty crime.
Well, I think what was for a long time counterintuitive is becoming ever more intuitive for a lot of innovative thinkers out there and for the social movements who are pushing for change in the system. I think we're going to see increasing collaboration between the movement against mass incarceration and the movement for immigrant rights. And I think that district attorneys who insist on sticking to the same old law and order playbook are going to find themselves in trouble come election time. With Trump taking office, the sort of mass deportations that were normal for a lot of Americans have now been associated with his toxic brand. I hope that things that were deemed okay under quote-unquote normal presidents have now been shown to be what they truly are. Policies that don't make our country safer, instead they actually just lead us to have the most bloated, gargantuan prison population on earth and lead to the deportations and separation of millions of families.
Daniel, thank you.
Thank you.
Daniel Denver is a fellow at the Fair Punishment Project and host of The Dig, a podcast from Jacobin Magazine. He is also working on a forthcoming book from Verso about immigration politics from 1965 to Donald Trump. In 2014, On the Media devoted an entire episode to the murky legal territory of the U.S. border, a place where there's almost no transparency or accountability, and where constitutional rights seem to be suspended. At the time, we heard from reporter Bob Ortega of the Arizona Republic, who had found that on-duty Border Patrol and Customs and Border Protection agents had killed at least 42 people between 2005 and 2013, with virtual impunity and in secrecy.
The Border Patrol and Customs and Border Protection have a policy that they do not release the names of agents. They do not release any details whatsoever about any actions that they may or may not take internally. And by the way, even their own policies on use of force are secret. They will not release those to the public. Most law enforcement bodies do.
One of those actions was the 2010 death of Sergio Hernandez, a Mexican 15-year-old who was on Mexican soil when he was shot by a U.S. border agent named Jesus Mesa, who fired from the United States. The case has reached the U.S. Supreme Court, and the eight justices heard arguments in Hernandez versus Mesa this week. The court must decide whether non-U.S. citizens are protected by the Fourth Amendment, but it also sheds light on concerns about accountability at the border. Deepak Gupta is a lawyer for the Hernandez family. Deepak, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin, please, with how the Border Patrol reported what happened on that day at the Juarez-El Paso border.
So a day after the shooting, the federal authorities claimed that this Border Patrol agent had shot Sergio in self-defense. And they put out a press release claiming that there was a group of suspected aliens being smuggled into the United States from Mexico and that they were throwing rocks at the agent, that the agent gave verbal commands for them to stop and retreat, and that instead these boys surrounded the agent and continued to throw rocks at him. The problem with the federal government's account is that 2 days later, several cell phone videos surfaced, and they showed a completely different story. The video showed that Mesa, this agent, was not surrounded by the boys when he fired his weapon. Sergio is hiding behind a pillar under this bridge and is peeping out, sticks his head out, and the agent fires at him in the head. He falls to the ground and dies, and the agents do not come to assist him, and they allow him to die.
Now, if this episode had been about 20 yards north of where it took place, a lot of things might well have happened. The agent would have faced certainly administrative investigations. He may have been prosecuted for manslaughter or worse, and he would have been subject to a wrongful death suit by the child's parents. What did happen to Mesa?
Well, he wasn't disciplined at all, and this is part of a pattern that we see, as your listeners know from previous reporting you've done with the Border Patrol, which is that agents who engage in the use of unjustified deadly force and violate the Border Patrol's own protocols are not disciplined, nothing happens, and in fact, the incidents are secret, and even the policies and outcomes are secret. And so this is not, unfortunately, an isolated incident.
The family did want to sue, but was stymied. And this is precisely what is at issue with the Supreme Court, no?
Yes, that's right. The first question is, does the Constitution apply at all here in this border zone? The second is this officer immune? Meaning, even if he violated the Constitution, is the officer immune from a damages lawsuit? And the third question is, do we allow an implied claim, a damages action under the Constitution, even when Congress hasn't created a remedy? The position taken by the border agents' lawyers and by the Trump administration's lawyers is that Sergio and his family have no constitutional protections, even for unjustified deadly force, because he was a Mexican citizen standing just a few inches into Mexican soil.
We do a whole mess of things on the other side of our borders, including drone strikes and routine intelligence activities that, as the justices observed in hearing arguments in this case, might be affected if everything we do across our borders is subject to litigation.
So we know that the Constitution does extend beyond the border. We also know that there can't be a kind of global constitution that constitutionalizes every military engagement. And so the question in this case is, where do you draw the line? And our pitch to the court is, at least if the officer is standing on U.S. soil and the victim is standing in this liminal border zone, this area where the borderline is invisible and there's at least some degree of joint responsibility for the area, that it's not too much to ask to say that there should be constitutional protection there. And the alternative to that is to say that there's no judicial review at all.
Now, here is where politics rears its head. The position that the Trump administration is taking is fundamentally the same as the position the Obama administration took. But the swing vote on the court may well be, as it often is, Justice Anthony Kennedy, who suggested this is a matter too sensitive to be resolved by the courts and should be really a call from the executive branch. That does not bode well for you, does it?
Well, I think it's always a hazard to read too much into the questioning at oral argument. What we do know about Justice Kennedy is that he believes very strongly that the Constitution does not stop at the border. The case in which the Supreme Court held that even terrorists held at Guantanamo had constitutional rights was written by Justice Kennedy. The other thing I'd say just about the shift in administration is that, you know, of course the Supreme Court decides these cases on the law and their best understanding of the Constitution, but they're also not blind to the reality of what's going on in the world.
They get to read the papers.
Exactly. And they, like all of us, have seen the incredible chaos that's been unleashed by the Trump administration with this reckless Muslim ban. I have to think that at least some of them are quite alarmed, and they understand that when the Trump administration comes to them and says, look, trust the executive, when there are implications for national security, immigration, and foreign policy, the judiciary has no role to play here. That argument sounds a lot different now than it did a few months ago.
Maybe the most mind-boggling thing about this case was not what happened to Hernandez, but that we have a police agency in the United States of America that is so insulated from the norms of process, transparency, and so forth. What is the explanation for this entity having the unchecked power that it seems to have?
It's true that it happened in the Obama administration as well, and many of us may have looked the other way. And now we're taking a closer look, and what we're seeing is an organization that allows officers to abuse people's rights with impunity. And you know, I think it maybe has something to do with the way in which immigration policy has become a kind of third rail, and the Obama administration itself deported very many people and I think didn't feel that it had the political capital to crack down. But now we should all be alarmed by this because we have an administration that has shown it is really willing to push the envelope. And I think a lot of us wrongly assumed that talk about a Muslim ban and a deportation force, that that was just talk. And we've now seen that the administration is actually serious about both things. To allow those policies to be implemented by this completely secretive and unaccountable law enforcement agency, I think is just unacceptable in a country that considers itself bound by the rule of law.
Deepak, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Deepak Gupta is an attorney for the parents of the late Sergio Hernandez. Hernandez. Coming up, what if they held a federal elections commission and nobody commished? This is On the Media.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. The Federal Elections Commission was established post-Watergate to enforce campaign finance laws and increase transparency. But for several years, it has failed to do that. Why? Because it's a six-member commission that can have no more than three members of one party at any time and needs four votes to act, which in recent years has yielded partisan gridlock. One of the FEC's three Democrats has had enough. Commissioner Ann Ravel recently announced her resignation and published a report detailing the FEC's, quote, dysfunction and deadlock. Well aware of obstructionist tactics in the Congress, Ravel says she was nonetheless shocked when her Republican colleagues refused to investigate campaign finance violations, no matter the evidence and no matter her efforts to accommodate their concerns.
The first year that I was on the commission, out of 25 enforcement matters, I voted with the Republicans on 20. It seemed to me that that good faith, though, was not acknowledged and that it was not going to be possible for me to get any agreement from this block of Republicans.
Not just block of Republicans, but blockade. According to your report, they voted together against taking enforcement action in, was it 98% of the cases brought before them?
Yes. And we really deadlock significantly more than ever before. And the fines that are imposed when we do not deadlock on matters are so incredibly low that in a few years, it went from more than $5.5 million in fines in 2006. And in 2016, the penalties that were imposed by the FEC was $595,000. My colleagues never agreed to look at the issues having to do with the foreign money that is clearly in our elections and that comes through limited liability corporations or 501c4s that are supposed to be social welfare organizations.
Tax-exempt organizations because they are performing something for the greater good. They are explicitly forbidden to undertake as their major purpose campaign finance. And yet, there was one called Carolina Rising that spent 97% of its budget on a Senate race in North Carolina.
Well, let me tell you a little more about that case. The night of the election, the person who was the head of Carolina Rising, wearing a hat with the name of the senator, was at the senator's victory party, and he said on TV, "We did it." And they did do it.
And the FEC looked into this and ruled how?
The commission stalemated 3-3 because they did not think that they should be a political committee and disclose their donors. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about 501c4s and whether or not they are a political committee versus just a true social welfare organization. It's transparency to the public.
Now, it turns out that campaign finance irregularities are an equal opportunity swamp. There are excesses, abuses, and maybe even criminal acts from campaigns of both parties.
Absolutely. And their refusal to investigate or enforce the law was also nonpartisan in that sense. I think an example that explains that is at the beginning of the campaign in 2016, there was an allegation made to the commission relating to Hillary Clinton and the Ready for Hillary PAC. And that case, like all the others, also stalemated 3-3 with the Democrats wanting to investigate the Ready for Hillary PAC and the Republicans wanting to dismiss and not do anything.
Which at first blush seems counterintuitive, unless you see this not as judgment on the merits of a particular case, but on an ideological determination not to investigate the source of political money. Is that what's at the heart of this?
I think that there is definitely ideology that is governing the bloc behavior, not purely partisanship, although I've been told that it ultimately is partisanship in the sense that the major violators in certain kinds of cases do tend to be Republican committees, although there are those on the Democratic side as well.
What's frustrating as a member of the public is that the gridlock that you're describing at the commission is in addition to Citizens United, which legalized all sorts of corporate and super PAC donations that otherwise had been strictly limited.
Well, the decision in Citizens United specifically said that one of the protections for all of these independent expenditures was that we have a robust disclosure system and that the internet and technology can give that information about who's funding campaigns and where the money is being spent to the public to prevent corruption. But the reality is that we can't.
Now, compounding the problem you've described is that the courts have been loath to intervene, to force the FEC into conducting an investigation that a deadlocked vote has prevented. It's not that outsiders haven't tried to get the courts involved, but they've stayed out of it. Why?
Well, what they decided some time ago was that when there is a split, stalemated vote on the FEC, the winning vote, which is the vote that wanted nothing to happen, gets deference from the courts. It's called Chevron deference that is normally given to federal agencies or other administrative agencies because they have greater expertise in a particular matter. But in this case, it doesn't fit that rationale. Nonetheless, the courts in the past have consistently given deference to that block of commissioners.
When the law for the FEC was designed, they intentionally avoided the usual model of having the party that controls the White House having the tie-breaking vote. The idea was to make it impossible for the FEC just to go on partisan witch hunts. But the effect might as well be called the Witch Impunity Act, because there's no hunting going on at all. Was it stupid?
No, actually, it makes sense if you have people on the commission who believe in the mission and are willing to follow the law, that they come to the table in good faith. But what we have now, because of the extreme polarization both in Congress and represented that way on our commission, paralyzing the agency is a higher priority.
What's the consequence to you of going on the record accusing your Republican colleagues of bad faith?
The consequence has been somewhat personal in that they have utilized certain media to spread lies about me, such as that I'm you know, trying to shut down the internet and part of the Chinese censorship board and the like.
And the FEC runs around for 2 years putting out press releases saying, we want to regulate talk radio, we want to regulate political speech, we're going to call it political and not let you do it unless it's approved by the FEC, and then you got to pay for your speech. Are you kidding, you monster woman?
Which has led to thousands of people on Twitter and on the internet trying to hurt me, kill me, do misogynist things to me. So there's that.
They've unleashed the trolls.
And they've done it purposely. And I know that because I have actually gone to speak to them about it, but to no avail. But in my view, speaking out is more important because I see my job as representing the American public, and they do not. And so I think I'm doing what's right by telling people about what's happening to this agency.
Commissioner, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Ann Ravel is Democratic Commissioner on the FEC. Her tenure ends in March. And that's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Michael Loewinger, Sara Kari, Leia Feder, and Kate Bakhtiarova. And our show was edited this week by executive producer Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Rick Kwan and Terrence Bernardo. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm delighted, and I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.